WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a room full of neurotic, egotistical, legendary comedy writers, we talk with Larry Gelbart about what it was like to be part of Sid Caesar's comedy team, which also included Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, and Neil Simon. This week, PBS broadcasts their reunion, Caesar's Writers. Larry Gelbart went on to develop the film MASH for television and co-wrote the book for the Stephen Sondheim musical, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which is now revived on Broadway. Also, we hear a reading by playwright and actor Sam Shepard, recorded at the 92nd Street Y in New York City, and linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on the Olympic coverage by France and the U.S., and what that reveals about how each country tries to protect its language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The former Arkansas governor convicted in the Whitewater trial will be sentenced today, but the sentencing of another convicted Whitewater figure has been delayed. Michael Hiblin of member station KUAR reports from Little Rock.
Former Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker is to be sentenced for his conviction in May on 11 counts of fraud and conspiracy. Tucker could face up to 10 years in prison and up to $500,000 in fines. Former banker James McDougal was also to be sentenced today, but has had his sentencing pushed back to November 19th. There have been reports in the last week that McDougal has begun cooperating in the Whitewater investigation, a claim McDougal has neither confirmed nor denied. McDougal is a former business partner of President Clinton's, and his sentencing being pushed back suggests that McDougal may indeed be giving information to prosecutors who want to give him a chance to talk with them before being sentenced. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Hiblin in Little Rock.
President Clinton is spending today, his 50th birthday, hanging sheetrock at a Tennessee church. The predominantly black church was destroyed by fire. The president will be assisted by First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton and Vice President Al Gore and Mrs. Tipper Gore. The Tennessee visit ends 2 days of campaigning aimed at increasing Mr. Clinton's campaign visibility. Efforts by the French government to enforce a tough immigration law have turned into a public relations nightmare. Movie stars, opposition politicians, and hundreds of young people have joined some 300 African immigrant aliens demonstrating at a Paris church. David Culhane reports.
Most of the demonstrators are from the African nation of Mali. 10 of them are now in the 46th day of a hunger strike at St. Bernard Roman Catholic Church. Over the weekend, Prime Minister Alain Juppé and other government ministers affirmed their determination to expel the illegal immigrants, except for those who have children born in France. But the opposition Socialist Party is now demanding new negotiations, arguing that some of the demonstrators had legal residency but lost it under the controversial 1993 immigration law reform. Official action to clear the church and deport the aliens seems imminent. But in the meantime, the government is suffering a public embarrassment. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
An Arabic daily newspaper based in London reports Algerian Muslim militants attacked two buses over the weekend and slaughtered at least 63 people. The passengers were reportedly rounded up. All passengers that were from one particular town were killed. An Algerian paper reported a similar attack by militants last Thursday that killed 17 people. None of the attacks have been confirmed by Algerian authorities, and no one has claimed responsibility for them. On Wall Street, the Dow's up a fraction of a point at 5690. This is NPR. Aides to Russian President Boris Yeltsin say he's getting a medical checkup, but they deny a report in Time magazine that he needs heart surgery abroad. The Time report says the Kremlin considered sending Yeltsin to Switzerland for double-bypass heart surgery. The magazine cites a Kremlin medical advisory detailing Yeltsin's serious condition. The aides say the president is working, but they add he's decided against making a speech, marking the fifth anniversary of the failed Soviet coup this week. The Justice Department reports overcrowding in prisons is becoming common because of an increase in convicts from federal and state courts. Nora Rahm reports.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons estimates there are 1.6 million people in prison nationwide. That's double the number of prisoners 10 years ago and 6.8% higher than just 1 year ago. Most of the inmates, a million of them, are being held in state penitentiaries. 500,000 are in local jails and 100,000 are in the federal prison system. The increase in incarceration can be attributed to tougher sentencing laws. Many states have curtailed or eliminated parole, and many have adopted some version of the three strikes and you're out policy, mandatory life sentences for repeat offenders. The prison population is overwhelmingly male. Women account for only 10.2% in local jails and 6.1% in federal prisons. I'm Nora Rahm in Washington.
Authorities at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, hope an autopsy will show how an 18-year-old midshipman died this past weekend. A roommate found the body of Joanna Simer in her dormitory room yesterday. The Minnesota woman had just completed plebe training. A spokesman for the Naval Academy says there were no signs of foul play, trauma, or suicide. Simer is described as a model midshipman who excelled during her first weeks in Annapolis. Investigators will check her activities during her last day to find any clues. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, many public TV stations are presenting Caesar's Writers, a program which reunites Sid Caesar with some of the comedy writers that made his show one of the big successes of early television. The writers include the now-famous Neil Simon, Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, and my guest Larry Gelbart. Gelbart wrote for Caesar from 1955 to 58. Caesar hired Gelbart away from Bob Hope. Gelbart later developed the TV series MASH and served as its principal writer and wrote the screenplays for Oh God, Tootsie, and Barbarians at the Gate. He wrote the book for the Stephen Sondheim musical A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which is now revived on Broadway. To get an idea of what Caesar's shows were like, here's a sketch with Carl Reiner as a roving reporter interviewing the famous Viennese sleep expert Dr. Sigmund von Sedative, played by Sid Caesar.
Doctor, I wonder if you can show us your own personal method for falling asleep.
Of course, that's all. See, most of the people, they walk in when they, you know, they just get into bed very gently, you know? My method, you come into bed, you flop into bed. You flop into bed and you relax a bit. Well, then you concentrate. You concentrate, you say, all right, toes, good night. Good night, toes, come on, go to sleep. When you see right away, they curl up and they drop off. To sleep, they drop off to sleep. Well, then you say, good night, ankles. Good night, knees. And pretty soon you see the legs are asleep. When you tell the stomach, come on, good night, stop the mixing in there. Hang up the shoes. Go to sleep. When you tell the chest, you did a nice job today. You did work good. Stop the breathing. Come on. When you tell the throat, come on, okay, stop that. All right, brain, come on, go to sleep. Brain, will you please go to sleep? Come on, everybody else is sleeping. Why don't you do that? Listen, don't holler so loud, will you please? You'll wake up the stomach. Will you please go to sleep like a night? I got a brain that's out of his mind. Now let's go. Will you please go to sleep again? Well, don't holler so much, will you please? You'll wake up the whole... You don't want to go to sleep, huh? You don't want to go to sleep? All right. I shut it. All right, everybody up! Everybody. Someday you want to go to sleep, I wouldn't let you sleep. Now, what are you...
I asked Larry Gelbart to recall one of his favorite Sid Caesar sketches, and he described a takeoff of Hollywood musicals about three sailors on leave who meet three waitresses who turn out to be heiresses.
Well, Carl Reiner, Howie Morris, and Sid Caesar, of course, played the three sailors who arrive in New York on a 24-hour shore leave and just get involved in really all the movie cliches about meeting girls, falling in love, not being able to get back to the ship, hokey romance, bogus tap numbers, original songs. And I remember it culminated with them all getting married on the battleship and the admiral coming out and saying, as you know, we always do a big production number on our deck before we go off to war. And we did do a big production number. I guess it must be a favorite because it's the first one that sort of spun around on the wheel decks of my mind when you asked that question.
Do you remember the lyrics to the song?
Oh, something about uptown's up and downtown's down and the east side's on the east side and the west side's. I mean, they were just, you know, Cod, Comden, and Green.
Right.
Or Comden and Green, if you want.
Right. Now, what was it like writing for the Sid Caesar Show as a group? Was it a collective process?
It was a totally collective process. We were all locked in the same room together every Monday morning from 10 o'clock until 6. On a Monday morning, we say, well, what do we do this Saturday night? And by Wednesday, we had written an hour show that would have been one or two or three or four sketches, perhaps a mime routine, perhaps some special musical material. And by Thursday, Sid was in the rehearsal hall with the performers rehearsing the material, and it was broadcast live, that is to say, in front of an audience, without laugh machines, without tape machines, without any, you know, mechanical help. By Saturday night at around 10 o'clock, it was all over. We had Sunday to relax and to either enjoy or regret what we had done on Saturday night. And then Monday, it started all over again. But there we were, all in the same room, pitching jokes like crazy. Neil Simon captured it amazingly accurately and affectionately in a play he did a couple of years ago called Laughter on the 23rd Floor.
In an article in the New York Times a bunch of years ago, you described the writing room as supercharged, marvelously competitive, and literally violent. I'd like to hear about the violence.
Everybody wants to hear about the violence. A lot of the violence was directed at Mel Brooks. Mel, God bless him, I believe is the proper cliche at this moment. Mel is a vastly unique and talented man. He could not get to work on time. He was always late. And we resented it. And he knew we resented it, but it didn't stop him from being late. And so there were times when we would burn him in effigy.
Literally?
Literally. We would have a hat, a shirt, a jacket or something of him, set fire to it in this office building in New York City on 57th Street. Mel once wrapped me on the bottom of my feet with a ruler. I was sitting up with my feet up on the desk, and for some reason he just smacked me across the bottom, so they really hurt. And so when I first chance I could get, I threw his shoes out the window. He had taken them off because he was napping or something, and so he had to go downstairs barefoot and buy a new pair of shoes. There was an awful lot of ambivalence in the room, and the negative side of it often, you know, resulted in that kind of violence, although not continuously. And we didn't even have time for that kind of nonsense, truly, but we took a moment or two to vent our collective spleens.
I imagine there was a lot of ego and a lot of neurosis in the room.
Probably more neurosis than ego, because when you're in what amounts to a dugout of writers, you know, a battery of writers, you're punching away. You don't smart because one joke, you know, wasn't accepted by the others. You come up with another one. When there's a good one, fine. That then you're one joke closer to having a sketch written, say. So while we all had healthy egos, neurosis. Oh, that we were. We were all very neurotic. Very neurotic. I like to think we all still are.
But proud no one of
more. But no one more neurotic than Sid. I mean, you know, it.
How did Sid Caesar's neurosis get expressed, and how did you deal with it?
Well, Sid was really kind of walking around encased in rage for a lot of years. I mean, he's talked about his own demons. His substance abuse and stuff. I don't want to elaborate on that, but Sid was a mess, and there were times he would come to the office wearing carrying a revolver.
You're kidding.
A Magnum revolver. Yeah.
Like loaded?
He was, and the gun was too. No, Sid did not drink until after 6 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
So we all used to try to get out of there about 5 minutes to six. But Sid had a lot of anger, and Sid was like a refrigerator in a sports jacket. He was a big man. Sid was Mel Brooks used the joke in Blazing Saddles, but once Sid was riding in Central Park, horseback riding in Central Park with his wife Florence, and Florence's horse threw Florence to the ground, and Sid got off his horse and punched Florence's horse right between the eyes, and the horse went down. I mean, we're talking about that kind of strength and violence that was, you know, set to go off in any second.
So when he would bring his gun to work, would he brandish it at the at the writers? What would he?
No. Sid, there was a time there for a while.
Oh,
Sid,
I know what he'd do. He'd go hold the gun to his forehead and say, "Oh," he'd hold out the gun and he'd say, "That those jokes stink. If you want to kill me, use this."
No. No, he didn't. No, there was a time. Sid went through a paranoid stage where he thought that Otto Skorzeny, the famous Nazi provocateur, was after him.
Oh,
so
gosh.
He was really carrying it in self-defense. Now it becomes understandable, I hope.
Right, that he was having paranoid delusions.
Yeah, that the man was going to surface in a submarine in the East River and come over to 57th Street and get Sid. Sid felt no violence towards us. He really did then and still does have a healthy respect for what we did with and for him.
Well, let me ask you, if he thought that someone was out to get him, who clearly wasn't, did you ever worry about how he was going to perform live on television?
No, Sid, we never worried for one second. The only thing we knew that Sid would not be sure of was being able to say good evening to the audience as Sid Caesar. Once he got into any sketch, any prepared material, once he could do a monologue, once he could do a mime, once he could play a character, he was fine. The only person in the world he did not know how to play was Sid Caesar. He had a neurotic, persistent hack. He would cough. It would be good evening, ladies. He could not say good evening, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we worried about. We thought that would be the whole hour, Sid saying good evening.
So would you have him say good evening in somebody else's character just to get him through that?
No, he had to be himself for a second.
Right, right.
Sid was often not himself when he was off camera. I mean, we talk about it in that session that we had when we got together. We talk about the fact that for almost a year, Sid spoke with a Polish accent. He pretended to be a Polish janitor, a maintenance man, and that's the way he can. That's the way he said good morning. That's the way he had lunch with you, and that's the way he said good night.
Wow, how strange.
So, no kidding.
Was it hard convincing him to do sketches that you really believed in?
No. He was a very good judge of material. All really good comedians are very good editors. They recognize what's right for them. They definitely know what's wrong for them. And he was brave. We would do satires based or parodies based on material that was not generally known or widespread, such as Japanese movies. When we did them, hardly anybody in the audience, the television audience, had ever seen a Japanese movie. We did very esoteric things and very brave things, and Sid was the bravest of all because he was the one out there in front of the camera doing it and risking his... his reputation and his ability to make people laugh by doing material that was very, very sophisticated.
Carl Reiner often performed on the Sid Caesar Show. Mel Brooks went on to become a performer as well as a writer and director. Were they more extroverted in the writing room because they were performers too?
Yes. We really thought of Carl as an actor, a performer who could also contribute to the writing. We thought of Mel as a very gifted writer who could also perform, but no one was more extroverted than Mel. I mean, Mel was a show. I mean, we really enjoyed Mel when we weren't burning him,
burning him in effigy, right?
Yeah, when we weren't pouring lighter fluid all over his clothes. He's vastly entertaining. He's surprising. Mel has, Charlie Chaplin said, that audiences laugh at two things. One, they laugh when they expect something and it happens. Such as the man approaching the banana peel that they know is there and he doesn't, or when it's a complete surprise. Mel was then and always is a complete surprise. You never know, I'm not sure he does, what he's going to say or do next.
My guest is Larry Gelbart. In the 50s, he wrote for Sid Caesar. He's one of the writers reunited in the program Caesar's Writers, which is being broadcast this week on many public TV stations. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Larry Gilbert, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, is revived now on Broadway with Nathan Lane in the role that was originated by Zero Mostel. That must be wonderful for you to have a revival like that.
Well, what's really very rewarding about it is the fact that Bert Shevelov, my co-author, and Stephen Sondheim, who did the score, I mean, we started writing that show 40 years ago. And it's nice to know, you know, that the ink hasn't faded, that it, that it still works for a modern audience. And this is the third time around, actually. We had a, it first ran in 1960, opened in 1962, and there was a revival in 72, and now there's this one in 96. So it's third time around, and it's done well every time. So it's a great compliment to us.
Now, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum is based on the plays of the Roman writer Plautus, who was born in 254 B.C. So this guy wrote a long, long time ago. What's the connection between Plautus and Forum?
Total. We read the 26 plays of his, which still exist, 27 plays of his, which are extant, and we selected a character here, a character there, a bit of a storyline here, and another one from another play, and then started adding our own connective tissue and our own Plautine-like complications. So it's a direct line from work that is over 2,000 years old to what they're doing on Broadway today. There is one line in the play which was done in 200 B.C., where Miles Gloriosus, the braggart warrior, says to his admirers, he says, "I am a parade." And it always gets a laugh. Steve worked it into a lyric. And that line, as I said, is about 2,500 years old.
Was Plautus the Roman father of low comedy?
He was the Roman father of low comedy. I got in trouble writing a piece recently for the New York Times in which I said he invented it all. The truth is he adapted a great deal of it from the Greeks, from Menander and others. But he was certainly one of the first people to introduce comic conventions. I mean, one would think comedy was always with us, and in fact it has always been with us, but these were people who organized that comedy. They gave us stereotypes. They gave us the henpecked husband. They gave us the moonstruck young lover. They gave us the wily slave, the henpecked husband, and the braggart warrior, and situations, mistaken identities, all sorts of comic conventions which have not been changed or improved upon in two millennia.
You were the principal writer for MASH from 1972 to 1976. You're the guy who developed it from the film. Did it seem to you when you were starting on MASH that a mobile surgical unit in the Korean War was the perfect subject for a TV sitcom?
No. I think it was the perfect setting for a television half hour. I don't think that MASH... I never have thought of it
as a sitcom,
truly, because of what sitcom has come to mean. You know, the "Hello, Honey, I'm Home" kind of show.
Well,
three camera tape, studio show. You know, in a funny way, Forum is more of a sitcom than MASH is, because all the laughs in that show are situational. They all derived from situation. No, I just thought that MASH, as a weekly show, could address an area of human behavior that would lend itself to comedy and more, a comedy in a minor key, much as the theme song.
Suicide is Painless.
Yeah, but yes, I did think it was going to be something I would enjoy writing.
Did you think of Vietnam as being the subtext when MASH premiered in 1972?
Well, I was kind of able to travel on two mental tracks, to create a very clumsy phrase. I had been in Korea when I worked for Bob Hope. I had gone over there when he entertained the troops. And so I knew Korea. I knew that war. I knew that place. I knew the way it smelled, literally. And so that never left me as I worked on the series, but I was also obviously very, very conscious of the fact that we had the opportunity, the rare opportunity in an entertainment capacity, in the field of entertainment, to comment on this disastrous involvement that our country had in Vietnam.
Do you have a favorite episode?
I think my favorite episode is the least written episode, and that was the one that was sort of my valedictory episode. It was the last episode of the fourth year, and it was called The Interview, and it's in black and white. And it consists of a series of interviews with the actors in character talking about the war, how they feel about it. And I think it was rather a remarkable document, if I can be so modest. I can be so modest because a lot of it was improvised. A lot of what the actor said was not written for them. They came up with it themselves.
You left MASH after 4 years. You left in 1976.
Right.
Why did you leave? The show was really popular.
Well, I had given it my best and my worst and everything in between. I just felt it was time to move on. I mean, mm-hmm. It was getting too easy and too hard at the same time. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want to fall back on cliches of my own. I didn't want to. I was desperate to keep it fresh and interesting to me so that it would be that way to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure I could do it anymore.
You've written a lot of drag humor over the years. You co-wrote Tootsie.
Yes.
Of course, Klinger was in drag during a lot of MASH.
Yes.
And there's some drag humor in Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
You can see how far drag humor goes. That you know that was taken from, you know, the convention that began
ancient Rome.
Day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
mm-hmm.
You mean what's the attraction for me?
Well, you know, so what's so funny about? I mean, we've all, you know, laughed, but analytically, which I figured you might analyze this as a writer, analytically, what's so funny about a man in a dress, particularly if it's like a straight man in a dress?
I don't know. I'm sitting in front of a mirror now in the dress, and I don't think it's very funny. I think it's very attractive. what's funny is it just knocks the props out of any kind of, you know, ridiculous masculine ego. It just lets us be, because it's just such a reversal of what we think we are and what we hope to come off as. I mean, that's not a very scholarly response, but I think that's going to have to do.
Larry Gelbart will be back with us in the second half of our show. You can see him on the program Caesar's Writers, which is being broadcast this week on many PBS stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Larry Gelbart. We hear a reading by playwright and actor Sam Shepard, and linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how France and the U.S. covered the Olympics and what that reveals about how each country tries to protect its language. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Larry Gelbart. In the 50s, he wrote for Sid Caesar. He went on to develop the TV series MASH and to write many of the episodes. He also wrote the screenplays for Oh God, Tootsie, and Barbarians at the Gate. Your family moved to Hollywood when you were a kid. And
yes.
Your father was a barber.
My father is a barber still.
Is still a barber, wow.
89 years old and still barbering.
Where? Out of his home or a barbershop?
Beverly Hills. My father has the rare distinction of having been a barber to both JFK and Harry Ruby.
Wow. Harry Ruby, the songwriter Harry Ruby?
No, Harry Ruby. Jack Ruby, excuse me.
Oh.
Jack Ruby. And his son has the rare distinction of having Alzheimer's before his father. Jack Ruby, who of course, shot Lee Harvey Oswald.
Wow. Well, yeah, okay. When the family moved to Hollywood, your father started cutting the heads of movie stars like Edward G. Robinson, Gregory Peck, George Raft. How did he become barber to the stars?
We were in living in L.A. in Hollywood, and it just happened that the shop where he finally was able to practice his trade was heavily populated with named people. It was called Drucker's Barbershop in Beverly Hills, above a very exclusive men's haberdashery called Jerry Rothschild's, and all these people came in there. All of them from from the stars to other stars, to gangster stars, Bugsy Siegel, Mickey Cohn, people like that, and presidents.
The story of your father cutting the hair of celebrities, I think, segues perfectly into the story of how you became a professional comedy writer. So let me let you tell the story.
Well, one of my father's clients was Danny Thomas. We are now, of course, talking about 45, 46. Before that, 43. And he told Thomas that Thomas was appearing on a radio show called the Fanny Bryce Maxwell House Coffee Time. For younger audiences, Fanny Bryce was the woman that Barbara Streisand portrayed in the show Funny Girl. And for even younger audiences, Barbara Streisand is the mother of Jason Streisand, Jason Gould. At any rate, my dad, quite on his own bat, because I had never, ever, ever thought of writing as a living or even something I could do, writing comedy. I was the typical sort of high school show-off who put on plays and whether it was in the auditorium or in the geography or history class, I was always cutting up, mostly to cover up the fact that I had not done my work. But anyway, he said to Thomas, "My son is very clever. Would you like to have him write something for you?" And Thomas said, "Sure." I mean, what did it cost him, And so I wrote some material for him, and Thomas was impressed enough to pass me along to the head writer of a show, a man named Mac Benoff. Then Mac put me to work on the staff. I was 16.
Do you remember anything you wrote for him?
I remember a joke, because I remember standing in the control booth again and hearing it read by an actor at a microphone and having an audience laugh. And that was the first time that ever happened to me. I don't know what the buildup was. Somebody was being charged with some heinous crime, and the punchline, the man at whom these charges were directed, said, "I said I was sorry." I mean, I know that doesn't sound funny now, but that was the joke. Look at that. It's still getting a laugh.
I
feel like Plautus. And that was the joke, and I remember, all these years that was my first taste of this kind of reaction.
So you worked in radio in the last days of the radio variety show.
They were the last days. I was in radio from 43 or 4 until about 1950. Yeah, I guess those were the last days.
Yeah, by then people were making the transition to TV and moving their shows
exactly
into television.
Yes.
And you even worked on Duffy's Tavern.
That was my college, yeah. 2 years.
Yeah, describe that show for people who never heard it.
Duffy's Tavern was an imaginary tavern. It was a radio show, of course, as was said. It had a bartender named Archie. It had a few running characters, and every week it was visited by some a star. It could be a star of movies. It could be a star of the opera world. It was a very cultured show. And it was a show that treated language as its chief source of comedy, as opposed to, say, insults or almost any other form of comedy. It really was written for the ear, contained a great many spoonerisms, malapropisms were the chief tool of the show. And it was just, I say it was my university, because in those 2 years, I think I learned more than perhaps I've learned since about writing comedy.
Where did you learn jokes?
My father always told jokes. My earliest recollections are, you know, getting laughs as a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, being told, you know, tell him the joke about the baba bum, you know, which I'd already heard. And, you know, and my mother was wickedly funny on her own, not jokes, just her own humor. She had a real sharp, biting sense of humor. And needless to say, I don't think it came through my mother's milk, but I mean, as soon as I could understand, I think I understood that what she was saying was funny. And I don't know whether I was meant to emulate her or whether I thought that that's the way you dealt with life, that you used humor.
So what are you up to now?
Well, I'm out of high school now. That got that behind me finally. I'm working on a number of projects, actually. Do you want me to
sure.
be specific?
Yeah.
Well, I'm working on an original, which I will not have co-written with anyone, for HBO. We had great success over there with a piece I wrote.
Oh, Barbarians at the Gate?
Barbarians at the Gate, yeah. So I've written a piece which is an original, which is called Weapons of Mass Distraction. And it sort of looks at the notion of how a very small number of people keep a very large number of people entertained and distracted while very important things either go unnoticed or we become indifferent to, because we're always being fed, you know, these sort of tabloid circuses and other entertainments to keep our eye off the ball, and how legislation is purchased, and how this power corrupts us, and how the lateral damage it causes. It's meant to be funny, I mean, mm-hmm. without trivializing the subject, but it is a comedy. I think it's a very dark comedy. Anyway, that's the thing I'm currently doing. A couple of other things, but I tend not to talk about stuff, because if you talk about it long enough, you really resent then having to do it, you know?
Right. So one last question for you. Who cuts your hair?
Guess.
Your dad.
Yes, my dad cuts my hair still, and I still keep the tip has not changed in all these years. It's a big kiss on the lips.
Well, the tip hasn't changed, but what about the haircut? You're still getting the same haircut you got in 1940 something?
No, because the job takes about a quarter of the time now, because I don't have as much hair as I did in 1940 or even 1980. So it doesn't take too long.
Well, Larry Gelbart, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to talk with you, Terry. Thank you.
You can see Larry Gelbart on the program Caesar's Riders, which is being broadcast this week on many PBS stations. He wrote for Sid Caesar in the 50s. Larry Gelbart also wrote the book for the Stephen Sondheim musical, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. Nathan Lane is currently starring in the Broadway revival of that musical. So let's hear Nathan Lane in the cast recording. This is Comedy Tonight.
Playgoers, I bid you welcome. The theater is a temple, and we are here to worship the gods of comedy and tragedy. Tonight, I am pleased to announce a comedy. We shall employ every device we know in our desire to divert you. Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. Old situations, new complications. Nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight. Something expensive, something offensive, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Passions and potions, constant commotions, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. Old situations, new complications. Nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight.
Coming up, a reading by playwright and actor Sam Shepard. This is Fresh Air. Sam Shepard is a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, screenwriter, and actor who has the reputation of being remote and eccentric. The reading we're about to hear will help explain why. As an actor, Sam Shepard is best known for his portrayal of Chuck Yeager in the film The Right Stuff. He appeared in Paris, Texas, for which he also wrote the screenplay. He was also featured in the films The Pelican Brief, Defenseless, and Steel Magnolias. His plays include Buried Child, The Tooth of Crime, True West, and Cowboy Mouth. Now Shepard has a new book of short stories called Cruising Paradise. Our reading begins with an excerpt of the book. This was recorded at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan.
I'm an actor now, I confess. I drive, I don't fly. I've been having some trouble getting work lately because of this not wanting to fly business. Plus, I refuse to live in L.A. I live as far away from L.A. as possible. In the South. Not the deep South, but South enough where they still call a river a ribba. In a Buick, a brick. I don't own a fax machine or an answering service or call forwarding or a cellular car phone or a word processor. And I've never volunteered for what they call press junkets. I don't know where the term junket came from in relation to the press, but I never did like the sound of it very much. And it has a kind of military ring about it, or maybe tapioca pudding, I'm not sure which. On top of all this, I'm not getting any younger. And my face is falling apart. Most of my lower teeth were knocked out by a yearling colt in the spring of 1975. Half my upper teeth are badly discolored, and one of them's been dead for as long as I can remember. When you get right down to it, I'm lucky to even have an agent at this point in time. I've been involved in many dangerous, foolish things over the years, more by accident than choice. I've been upside down under falling horses at a full gallop. I've been fired upon by a 12-gauge Ithaca over and under. I've rolled in a 1949 Plymouth coupe. And I almost blew myself up once with a plastic milk bottle full of white gas on a beach on the Bay of Fundy, where they have the highest tides in the world. Still, I would gladly go through all these dumb acts 10 times over rather than get on an airplane of any kind. I admit to an overwhelming vertigo that I don't understand and I'm unwilling to psychoanalyze. As I see it, it's a severe problem of the imagination. the inability to control mental picturings of stupefying height, the sensations associated with these picturings, the realistic sensation of falling without end. In any case, luckily, I love to drive. I've learned to love to drive. I love long distance driving, the further the better. I love covering immense stretches in one leap, Memphis to New York City, Gallup to LA, St. Paul to Richmond, Lexington to Baton Rouge, Bismarck to Cody, leaps like these, without a partner, completely alone, relentless driving, driving until the body disappears, the legs fall off, the eyes bleed, the hands go numb, the brain shuts down, and then suddenly something begins to appear. This is from a new book I'm working on. This is called Gary Cooper or the Landscape. Why don't you fly? I find that so fascinating. I don't know, I just don't. You drive everywhere? Yeah, or take trains. I love trains, me too. I used to take them all the time when I was a child in Sweden, all over Europe. Yeah. They rock you to sleep just like a mother. But say you have to be in Los Angeles suddenly, how do you get there? I never have to be anywhere suddenly. But your work, sometimes you must have to work in Los Angeles. Yeah, then I drive. Across the entire country? Right. Well, how far is that? It's a long, long way. Must be thousands of miles. It is. So you've done this many times, I guess. Many, many times. I've always wanted to do this. I must try it sometime. I've heard so much about this country, but I've never really seen it, you know, I mean, other than New York and L.A. You should try it. Well, what do you do? Is there a particular route you take? Highway 40 West. Is that the main highway? Yeah. Replace the old Route 66, you know, Grapes of Wrath, Henry Fonda, you know, get your kicks on this. I see. But aren't there little highways left that might be more interesting? What are you interested in? I mean, the main highway must be so synthetic, isn't it? They're all made out of asphalt. No, but I mean the surrounding areas, the little communities. There are no communities. But there must be some little towns with little side roads that are all the same. Well, aren't there some that are more picturesque, more authentic? They're all authentic. I see. Well, where do you stay when you're on the road like that? I sleep in my truck. Oh, you have a truck? I do, yes. I love trucks. Yeah. Trucks and trains. I just love them. You should get a truck. Oh, no. Why not? Get a truck and drive. No. I'd get so bored with myself driving all that way alone. Don't you ever get bored? No. You travel all by yourself and you never get bored? Never. I don't know if I could stand it all that way across the country. So huge. How many days did it take you? 5 usually, depends. Sometimes I stop along the way. You must have a lot of girlfriends in different towns. Not anymore. Don't you get lonely? Sometimes. I would get so lonely, I think. Yeah. You probably shouldn't try it. Oh, but I must. I feel as though I'm missing out on something. Since I was a little girl, I've dreamed about the West. In Sweden? Yes, I used to have visions about it. Visions? Vistas would appear. Where did you hear about the West in Sweden? Movies, American movies. We see that great landscape in our dreams and it haunts us. So it's the landscape that grabs you more than the characters? Yes, that vast background. So in Sweden, when y'all are watching an American Western, you're all staring at the background, is that it? I suppose it's so evocative as to us, all that space. Sweden is very close. So it doesn't matter who's in the Western. It could be John Wayne or Jerry Lewis, because everyone's really captured by the landscape. Well, we love the actors too, of course. Who's your favorite? Mine personally? Yes. Do you have a favorite? Well, I guess I would have to say Gary Cooper. Ah, the Coop. Oh, yes, he personified something, I think. What was that? Excuse me? That he personified. Oh, I don't know, that wonderful mixture of shyness, how do you say it? Vulnerability, I suppose, and yet strong at the same time. It's very Western. Women love that. They do. Oh, yes, very attractive, I find. Why is that? I don't know, you're making me blush. I am? Yes, you know you are. You're embarrassed? No, not exactly. But when you get right down to brass tacks, which is more important, Gary Cooper or the landscape? Oh, I would hate to have to choose between them. Say you had to. Say it was a question of life or death. I would have to say the landscape. There you go. But I love them both. Thank you.
Sam Shepard, recorded at the 92nd Street Y Unterberg Poetry Center in Manhattan. Our thanks to George Blood for post-production assistance. Sam Shepard's new book is called Cruising Paradise. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on language and coverage of the Olympics. This is Fresh Air. Linguist Jeff Nunberg watched the first week of the Olympic Games in France and the second week in the U.S. He observed some interesting differences in the style of coverage, which reminded him of the different ways that the French and the Americans go about trying to protect their language.
Here's what I learned watching the Olympics. There are styles in jingoism, too. Like the American broadcasters, the French spent most of their time on their own athletes. But the French didn't neglect to talk about the competitors from other nations. On the contrary, that was all a part of making the French team appear always embattled, beset by bad luck and the machinations of the judges and the other athletes. It came to seem a wonder that so many of them even managed to qualify for their events, and when they medaled, you had the sense that it was a miraculous triumph of the national spirit. I sat with a friend watching the air pistol coach explain the fourth-place performance of one of his competitors. Comprenez, he said, the organizers had the French competitors shooting at the worst times, and besides, there was a truck that went by just as the poor fellow was beginning his round. At which point my friend turned to me and said, "That's how it is with us French. The wind is always against us." It was a far cry from our own TV presentations, which gave us the rest of the world simply as a backdrop for the American triumph, freed even of the distraction of a Soviet threat to our medal totals. You had the sense that the NBC people would have preferred it if all the events could have been reduced to the men's basketball story. And indeed, the TV commentators sometimes found it hard to conceal their vexation when the script didn't play out as it should, after the Canadians had the effrontery to upset the traditional American domination of the men's 4x100 relay, I half expected Bob Costas to appear on the screen with an apology to American viewers on behalf of NBC. It's exactly the same with language. The French paint themselves as beleaguered on all sides by Anglo-American hegemony. Over the past few years, they've made it illegal to use English words in advertising and official announcements, and not long ago, President Chirac described English domination of the Internet as a major risk for humanity. And just before the Olympic Games, the Chirac administration dispatched a delegation to Atlanta to make sure that French was accorded its due official status at all events and ceremonies. There's a slightly paranoid cast to it all, which came through clearly in the French reactions when, during the second week of the Olympics, the American House of Representatives passed a measure aimed at making English the official language of the country and prohibiting the government from providing services in any other language. One French writer asked, "Is it simply coincidence that this bill comes up immediately after so many Yankees were doubtless stunned to hear French used before English in the stadiums of Atlanta?" There's not much you can answer to that. No one who asks a question that begins, "Is it simply coincidence?" is going to believe you if you tell them that the answer is yes, or indeed that Americans didn't give the language of the Olympic Games much thought at all. And when you do try to explain to the French what the American English-only movement is really about, their suspicion only deepens. What does a Frenchman make, for example, of Newt Gingrich's warning that bilingual programs could literally lead to the decay of the core parts of our civilization? It's true that the tone of this is just like the things you hear from the French all the time, except that Gingrich isn't talking as the French are about a threat from a major world language that surrounds them on all sides. What's at stake in this country is just providing some minimal foreign language services for immigrants who are waiting in line to get into underfunded English classes. When you listen to somebody trying to turn that into a threat to American civilization, you're reminded of Bill Walton trying to persuade TV viewers to stay tuned for the second half of one of those early round Dream Team games. "Well, the English language is up by 41 at the half, but this is a scrappy bunch of Central American immigrants, and you don't know but what Spanish could pull off an amazing upset here." It's no wonder that even world-class paranoids like the French have trouble believing that anybody could mean this seriously. But then, they're not accustomed to rooting for a team that has Barkley and Pippen up front, where no blowout is ever big enough for comfort.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Barbara Bogave, research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.